This episode of Literary Treks is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform for creating a blog, a website, a portfolio, or an online store. Create your own space today by visiting squarespace.com and use offer code TREK10 to save 10%. Plus, if you'd like to support our programming personally, visit trek.fm/donate to get our alien badges and art prints featuring original illustration by Tobu Ushi.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Are you taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading, in case I got bored.
Welcome everyone to another episode of Literary Treks, our Star Trek books and comics show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he is every week from down there in Texas, is my co-host, Matthew Rushing. Matthew, how's everything happening in Texas these days? Are you tuned in to the football that's happening down there?
Well, Chris, I mean, we've got football. We just had the state fair here in Dallas, Texas.
That's right.
So lots of fried food was consumed by lots of people.
State Fair. Let me just go ahead and interrupt you right there, because we've talked about this on shows before. What was the new, or have you heard, what was the new fried food item this year at the Texas State Fair?
Yeah, the newest fried food item, and the line was like an hour long, was fried Nutella. Now,
what is that?
It's Nutella. The spread.
Oh, the spread. Yes, okay.
Fried. And so now I didn't have that. I actually waited in the same line, but I got my favorite fried cookie dough, which is just so good.
Now that sounds pretty
good.
Really, I would eat that.
Oh my goodness, Chris. It's so good. And it was so worth the wait. But yeah, it was really crowded when we went because it was the last weekend. There are a billion people there. But if anybody happens to follow me on Twitter or Instagram, they would have seen my pictures. We went up in the big, huge Ferris wheel that's there, and it was right at dusk. And so some great pictures of downtown Dallas with the sun setting behind it. So really, really nice, even though it was crowded. It was fun.
That sounds fun. Wow. Ah, man. No fried alcoholic beverages this year?
Yeah, no. I mean, I think they learned their lesson with fried beer that it's gross and nobody wants really hot beer. It's just not good. So I'm glad that they've learned their lesson and we can move forward.
Okay, that sounds good. Now, if they put the beer in the batter that they put on things to fry it, that would probably be good. But
yeah, now that's a great itself. Idea, actually. I mean, if you're going to have fried beer, just use batter that's fry. I don't know. Anyway.
With beer in the batter.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
All right. Well, why don't we jump into our Star Trek news here? We have just a little bit of stuff in news this week. And the first one is, now, I didn't read this because I heeded your warning on the show notes page here, but a super spoilery new blurb for Peaceable Kingdoms in the fall series has come out.
Chris, it sure did. And likewise, you know, I had seen Dayton tweeting about this, and I really did heed his warning as well. I did not read this, so I just wanted people to be aware that it was there and it was available. I'm not looking. I don't want to know. In fact, Dayton and I actually talked about that on Twitter. I really don't want to be spoiled with this series. I am finishing up Uno's book right now, The Crimson Shadow, and it's fantastic so far. You know, David Mack's new book comes out next week, and so I can't wait to read that. So I just don't want to be spoiled with this series because so many big things are happening. I'd rather be surprised as I read instead of, you know, knowing everything going in. And so,
yeah, so like you said, when we were talking before the show, it seems that they're a little more comfortable now of spilling the beans on plot points because the series, you know, more of the books are out. But it is, and the reason we're telling everyone about it right here is, A, to let you know that it's there, but B, to warn you to be careful if you see these articles about books in the fall series that you haven't read yet, because they are starting to reveal things that will spoil the earlier books for you. So just be careful on that.
Yeah, definitely. I don't want people to, you know, accidentally pick up the back of, you know, a book and read the and think, oh no, I haven't read this one yet. Just be careful. And really, as I've already seen, this is really a good series. A lot of big things are happening. Really well written so far by the first two authors. I know David Mack, James Swallow, and obviously Dayton are fantastic writers as well, so I have no doubts that they're going to have great books. So big spoilers and big action and lots of great plot points coming. So me, personally, I don't like to know. You know, I used to be a big spoilers guy. Like, I always wanted to know what's going on, like in the TV show or the movie or whatever. Nowadays, I really stay away from that. I really enjoy having the story kind of play out for me, where whatever medium I'm in, whether it's a movie or, you know, a book or whatever. I don't want to know. So, but this is exciting. I'm glad that this is getting built up. It's a great series, and I look forward to seeing the 24th century continue, because, as we've talked about before, Kirsten Byers' Voyager book is going to kick off next year. So, ending the year with the 24th century and beginning the year with 24th century. So I'm excited about that.
Yeah, me too. I'm glad to see that. So watch for this coming out. Work your way through the fall. And then as we go along, we're going to have authors on. Of course, we had David R. George III on last week, and we have Una coming up here. So we're going to have everyone on as the books come out. Let's move into comics, Matthew, real quick. And, oh, you know, these press announcements about the comics, they always catch me off guard because, you know, to prepare for this show, we were reading Ongoing number 26, which came out this week. But, of course, this story is about Ongoing number 29 coming up. And the all-new five-year mission of the Enterprise continues as, apparently, Captain Jane Tiberius Kirk and her crew encounter a never-before-seen enemy in deep space. And yes, you heard me right, Jane Tiberius Kirk. What is going on, Matthew?
Chris, I really don't know, honestly. Maybe it's his sister from an alternate universe, or maybe in an alternate universe, Captain James Kirk was a woman instead of a man. Who knows which way she swings? So this could be a very, very interesting comic. We may be getting into that.
Wait till she sees Zara.
Exactly. We may be getting into that After Dark comic series. We've always wondered that they would do. So no, it's really intriguing. I like that there aren't really any spoilers here, other than what? You know, what's going on?
I have
on
my
here?
Own theory.
Yeah.
I have my own theory,
ooh,
Matthew.
What is it?
We don't know what happens at the end of the current four-part comic about the Kittimer conflict. I think that after Kirk is, when he escapes from the Klingons, which I think is going to happen, the Romulans will capture him, perform a sex change operation on him, and then return him to the Enterprise, and he will become Captain Jane Tiberius Kirk. From here forward in the Abrams verse, Captain Kirk's going to be a woman.
Yeah, wow, goodness. That is going to be interesting if that happens. I wondered if you were going to mention this exchange idea. So, hey, who knows? Anything is possible in the JJ verse.
It worked for Spot on The Next Generation. Why not Kirk?
That's true. Although with Spot, it's a little less obvious, but you know, whatever.
That's true. Well, you know, you've always pictured Kirk growing his hair out, right?
That, I don't know. Chris Pine with longer hair. Huh, that's a good question. We should Google that. I'm sure we'll find it somewhere.
This is what Photoshop is for.
Exactly. Matthew. We need to get Char on that. Or we could just get Mariel because, well, as we all know, she loves looking at pictures of Chris Pine. So pretty sure there's a long-haired picture of Chris Pine, she's found it.
Yeah, Trek FM News writer Mariel Kieran will do anything to look at pictures of Chris Pine.
So here we go, Chris. We've got a story.
Seems
for
right it. Up her alley. We do. Okay, so this is going to be coming out. Also coming out is going to be Con number 4. Now, we've only retcon number one so far. So we don't know what happens in 2 and 3 yet. But what we know from the press release here is that the secrets of Khan's revival in the future by Admiral Marcus and the agents of Section 31 will finally be revealed in number 4. So the eugenics wars are over. Number 4 is going to take us into that future time frame that we saw in Into Darkness. And that's what we know so far.
Yeah, this will be exciting. I think we all kind of wanted to see this in the film, you know, kind of know more about what happened with Khan getting woken up and how Section 31 found him, and maybe even just a little bit more background on this Section 31 and Admiral Marcus. I think that would be great. So this looks exciting. This will be the final in this series. So it's going to be, I think, a great thing to be able to finally get this full understanding of who this Khan is and why he's like this. And then the background of you know, somebody like Admiral Marcus, who I thought, you know, underutilized in the film in the sense of a villain, since he kind of turns into being the main villain. I would have loved to have seen more of him.
Right. I wonder if number 3 is going to have any lead-in involving Section 31 and Marcus, or if it's going to be all Khan up through the first 3, and then the 4th one is just going to jump us into the time when I guess they find the Botany Bay floating in space. Because he says in the movie, right, that he was found in the ship, and so those events played out, but it just wasn't the Enterprise that found him, it was Starfleet. And I don't think it was Admiral Marcus who personally found him. That wasn't my impression from the film, but they take him back to Earth, I guess.
Yeah, it'll definitely be interesting to see what happens. And so this is a good series already so far. We both love number 1. Hopefully 2, 3, and 4 will just continue to hold up those high standards that 1 set for us.
Yeah. So number 2 in the Khitomer conflict series, which we just kind of mentioned, you know, which is going to lead to Kirk's sex change operation at the hands of the Romulans, apparently, at least in my timeline it is, came out this week, and we've read that. And so we're going to pick up Matthew here and talk a little bit about the continuation of this story involving the Klingons and the Romulans and Section 31. And I went back and read quickly through the first issue again before reading the new one to refresh my memory on just what had happened. And then we picked right back up with the fact that at the end of the first one, the Klingons, Kor, in fact, has captured Kirk and the landing party, has them on the ship, and then we jump right into the action.
Yeah, this is, I love this series so far. I'm finding it really exciting because I don't know what's going to happen. I don't have any idea where they're going to take this and how it's going to work. I do enjoy seeing Kor here. One, it's a great callback to the original series. And I just have to say too, Chris, I don't know about you, but I really love the artwork in here. It held me captivated the whole time. The characters aren't perfect, but they look really good. You know, nothing really pulled me out. So the fact that, you know, too, they just start this issue right where the other one left off. You know, Kirk has been taken, and he's on Kor's bridge, beaten to a bloody pulp, as this new Kirk usually is. And, you know, now Kor is negotiating with Spock what they're going to do, whether they're going to, you know, fight or flight. And I really like this. And I think what was really interesting was the way that Spock deals with this, his idea that Kor is showing them some strange mercy. You know, he expects most, you know, any Klingon would have just blown him out of the sky. And I like that Spock is wisely playing on the fact that there's something else about this Kor that's a little bit different. And I think that's going to be interesting to watch play out in the series.
Yeah. Well, it is interesting. And again, I'm pretty much on record as at least aesthetically not being a big fan of what J.J. Abrams has done with the Klingons in the Abramsverse. But we often talk about how the Klingons in Star Trek are fairly two-dimensional compared to some of the other races. And even in Enterprise, the way they portrayed the Klingons was very much that way. You know, they're warriors, and that's kind of it. So it was interesting to me here in the conversation that Spock is having with Kor that, and again, we should let everyone know, spoiler alert, we are going to talk about a bit of what happens here. So if you haven't read it, you might want to grab it and read real quick before you continue on. But there's having this conversation, and Kor says, how like the Federation to presume we Klingons are simply animals that fight without thought or reason. And it was an interesting twist there for me. I wasn't quite expecting that, but they are already portraying the Klingons as being more than just warriors who are out to conquer anyone in their path. There actually is something else going on here.
Yeah, and I think that's what's kind of interesting in this this comic is you're getting the Romulan side where they seem to be kind of one-dimensional, just the duplicitous Romulans, and yet Kor here is kind of showing us that, you know, he's a thinking man's Klingon. He's not just a brute. And I do like that. I think it's really smart of them to do that and give us something different. I was thinking, wouldn't it be kind of interesting, Chris, is it in this Kittimer Accords, if one of the Daxes shows up, maybe Curzon, but Curzon's a woman in this or something like that? I'm just wondering if they'll throw him in there or at least Dax in there, since he's part of the Kittimer Accords in the background.
Right.
And so
that's true.
I'd be really interested to see if they did that, because that would be a lot of fun, I think.
It wouldn't surprise me if they did. You know, they've already brought in other characters from the past, even in this comic.
Yeah.
So that could work. You said you liked the artwork, and I was going to mention that I would say the artwork had me reasonably captivated until I got to page 19, and then it got me really captivated the first time we really get to see Zahra up close.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. I agree with you. That, man. And two, I love the joke that Kirk makes. Remind me to take you on every away mission where we get captured.
That's right.
Very, very funny. So
very specific.
So yeah, exactly. Just the ones where we're going to get captured, which with this Kirk is always. So I like that, Spock is able to warp out, go to safety, go to, I believe it's K-11 space station.
Yeah, K-11, yeah.
And, at this point, Kor is hoping that he runs, and then he interrogates Kirk a little bit, and he won't give him any information, and neither will any of the people with him. And again, there's a scene in here, and I think it's, let's see, I believe it's page 10, and where Kor is holding Carol's face, it looks just like Alice Eve. So really well done artwork here.
Yeah, I feel like, the Chris Pine artwork is really good as well. But one thing I noticed even in the first issue of the Kittimer Conflict is that Alice Eve's likeness is just really spot on in here.
Yeah, which is really cool for the characters to be able to see. So then the Romulans show back up, and they are talking to Section 31. Section 31 has these brand new fancy-ass ships, which I'm not going to lie to you, Chris, they're ugly.
Do you think they're ugly?
Oh, gosh.
Well, they're definitely weird-looking.
It looks like something out of Babylon 5.
Okay,
and that's not a compliment. Yeah. So,
but at the same time, I will say that they do have a Starfleet feel to them, just in the design. You know, you've got the basic round. It's not a saucer, but you've got the basic round front. You've got the nacelles, even though they're not in the same position.
Yeah.
And you've got the blue glow.
Yeah.
And it's, you see them and you know, okay, that's Starfleet, but I've never seen those before. And whoever designed those ships is up to no good.
Exactly. That they do let you know that these are bad guy Starfleet ships.
That's right.
Like, if they had come out of some sort of alternate universe, no, they're just the Section 31 ships. And so, and apparently, too, they have some sort of stealth technology which allows them to be able to stay in the shadows, quote unquote, even in space. So that's
well,
quite interesting.
I was wondering here, do we know at this point, do the Romulans have cloaking technology in the Abrams verse at this point? Because when I read that page, I kind of felt like they were implying that Section 31 has cloaking technology and the Romulans don't, and that that's how the Romulans are going to get it.
Yeah, that's something that's really interesting. I kind of wondered that as well, and if that's the case, I think it's a great way to go. It's very different. And so, you know, I have no problem with them kind of playing around with that idea here, that Section 31 was able to get cloaking technology either because of something they got an idea from Khan or something they've stolen or something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is really cool to see. And then, of course, we get Spock being back at the station and they're having a conference, a staff meeting. And, you know, they tell Spock, you know, you did exactly what you should have done, but I can't let you go back and look for Kirk, and I can't let you go try and rescue him. And so I thought that was an interesting call.
Are you very suspicious of these two admirals? I guess they're admirals on the screen. One of them's definitely an admiral. Are you suspicious that they're involved in the Section 31 bit, and that's why they don't want Spock to go after Kirk?
Well, I'm not suspicious right now. Maybe I should be. But I mean, I feel like their reasons were valid, you know, very valid. We don't want you going after him because we have a feeling that that's going to, you know, exacerbate the conflict. Now, per the end of the comic, where Section 31 does show up on Kronos, I don't know. That's a great question. I would hate to think we would have just another bad apple admiral. Seems like they already did that with Marcus, and they shouldn't play that card too many times.
Yeah. Well, but it might not be playing a card if your entire hand is full of badmirals, which seems to be the case at Starfleet Command.
Yes, your entire hand is full of badmirals. goodness, that's very true. I mean, but I'd hate to, I guess I'd also hate to think that much of Starfleet is, you know, terrible in this.
Yeah.
So, who knows? I don't know.
So they go on, and of course we've got Yuki here, Yuki Sulu, and
yeah, they have a conversation. Sweet moment.
Yeah, and then they go on to, they bring Khan back into it, which again I thought was, I mean, it's not unexpected, but they're, rather than Khan being in, mm-hmm. into darkness being just a one-off thing, they are still using his presence on Kronos as the catalyst for this animosity, growing animosity between the Klingons and the humans, more so the Klingons directed at the humans, but there's Khan. It's almost like in Star Trek IV when the Klingons bring up Kirk's image on the screen and they're like, I give you Admiral James T. Kirk, the architect of this. And here's Khan on the big screen.
Yeah, in fact, you know, that actually might be what they were thinking, Chris, then, and actually kind of using that. And so I think it's great that they're really utilizing the film and creating a bigger and more vibrant world because of it. And it's good story writing to continue to use a great thread point like that. And also bringing in the original film with this whole idea that these Klingon ships, they've been upgraded by the Narada that they've had, that they studied for so long, all of those things playing into what we saw even in the Nero comic. So they are really pulling a lot of things in here to create this. And goodness, why wasn't this the movie?
Yeah, I was thinking that too. I was thinking that I really enjoy this story because, as you mentioned at the beginning, we don't know where it's going. It's really an original story, and it's involving Earth, Romulans, Klingons, Section 31. You've got Kirk captured. You've got Spock trying to be captain of the Enterprise. It's just got everything going on, and it really would make an exciting movie. I think a better movie than Into Darkness.
Well, yeah, and you've got Zara, so, I mean...
And you've got Zara.
Yeah, exactly. This should be the film. In fact, I don't understand why they're doing this in the comic. I don't understand why this just isn't the third movie. It seems like it would be fantastic, and maybe it's just too complicated for a film, going back and forth and trying to introduce all of this stuff to people who don't know Klingons and Romulans and all of that. But man, is it good. So,
maybe so.
Yeah. So you get to the, you know, that Kirk's not going to tell them anything. They're being taken into prison in Kronos, deep, it looks like, underneath Kronos. And then, voila, the Romulans attack. Zara has gotten out of her handcuffs, which apparently she's really good at. Kirk might want to watch out for that. They are able to escape. And as they're running out, they run into Kor, who says, "I knew it was the humans." And bum, bum, bum. Section 31 shows up.
Yeah.
So, and then it's to be continued, which I was really disappointed in because it's such a good comic. I know that this is the middle part of the story, but I don't feel like they're leaving me lax in any way. I mean, they're not pulling any punches. They're really building the story. I don't feel like this is filler at all. The only part I thought maybe was filler was the whole Sulu Yuki thing, but other than that, this is good stuff. This is what I really had hoped that After Darkness was going to be, and they're finally doing it in the Kittimer conflict, and I'm so glad. Everybody needs to go get the Kittimer conflict series because it's fantastic.
Yeah, I agree. So that is Kittimer Conflict number 2. Now we have to wait another month for Kittimer Conflict number 3 to come out and find out what's going to happen next and what's going to go on here with Section 31. I did find it. I guess if I really think about it, maybe it makes sense. But they are kind of taking Section 31 from being this shadowy kind of spy organization or someone who's kind of pulling the strings behind the scenes, which is what we've always thought of them as being, to being a larger organization that has their own special starships, and now they come and they actually send ground forces down to enemy planets, and it's a little bit of a change for Section 31, but
they're definitely reminding me more of a Obsidian Order or a Tal Shiar, more so like than that. Just the what we thought of the Section 31 that's in the shadows and those kind of things. I mean, and not that that's terrible or bad. I think in this universe we need to do some things that are different, and taking those ideas from what we've seen through other powers and kind of using them for Section 31 works. So I'm okay with that.
Yeah, that sounds it works for me too in this context. So that's all we have for news today, Matthew. And as we told everyone last week, we were planning this week to do the Deep Space Nine short story Horn and Ivory, which is from Gateway's book number 7, which picks up the loose threads at the end of Demons of Air and Darkness that we did last week. But as it turns out, we were very fortunate to be able to get some time from Una to talk about her book in the fall series. And so Matthew was able to interview Una, and that's going to be our feature for today. So we'll be back next week to pick up with Horn and Ivory. And I hope this week everyone enjoys the feature with Una. But before we get to that feature, Matthew, let's tell everyone about our sponsor for this week's show, Squarespace. Squarespace is the web's best hosting and CMS that makes it simple for you to create your own blog, website, or portfolio. And also, Squarespace makes it extremely easy to sell items online with the integrated commerce feature. Now, this is something we've talked about before. We've talked about the deal they made with Stripe to integrate it into the system. And Squarespace Commerce is now available in a number of different countries, including the US, UK, Canada, Australia, Belgium, France, Germany, Ireland, the Netherlands, and Spain. And the list of countries is expanding all the time. And commerce allows you to sell both digital and physical products online. And the 30-second merchant sign-up gives you instant approval, and it does not require any paperwork, which is really fantastic. And you can begin receiving money for purchases via direct deposit in moments. And full tax and shipping rules by region also help you run your store. Plus, the order management interface lets you easily track outstanding orders, resend customer update emails, and print packing slips from a single interface. You can even move your existing Shopify or Big Cartel inventory over to Squarespace with just a few clicks. And you know, Matthew, I was thinking, because you can sell physical products as well, next year at the Texas State Fair, I think you should go and collect all the different fried foods and resell them on your Squarespace commerce site. It might sound a little bit disgusting, but you know, I think that it would work. You could sell them. People could refry them. Get a little sample of the Lone Star State.
Well, you know, I could do that, and hopefully they would, you know, be shipped to the person expediently so that they could get that. I don't know how that would work. Who knows? But yeah, we can try it.
Well, you know, here in Japan, we do have special courier trucks for cold or frozen items. So you just go to the state fair, you know, you get that deep fried Nutella you were talking about, take it home, freeze it, sell it. Everyone can take part in the state fair. It'd be fantastic. Okay, but I'm sure that most people will have more reasonable uses for Squarespace commerce. And the best way to find out how you can sell your items is to try it free for yourself for 14 days. There's no credit card required. The commerce plan is $24 per month. And if you want to do a website, a blog, or a portfolio, or any other kind of space you can think of, those plans start at just $8 per month and $16 for unlimited, which gives you absolutely everything that you need. There's no separate fee for hosting or for content management. It's all one unified platform. And as a Trek FM listener, you can save 10% off your lifetime purchase on new accounts by using offer code TREK10. Plus, if you choose the annual plan, you can get a free custom domain registration as well. So that's statefairdeepfriedfood.com. I'm sure that's probably available. It doesn't sound like something anyone would have registered before. So Matthew, you can get that for yourself by choosing the annual plan. So everyone, just go over to squarespace.com and try it for free. I know you're going to love it. And then when you sign up, be sure to use offer code TREK10 to get that 10% discount off your lifetime purchase. And we really thank Squarespace for their support of Trek FM, and we thank you for your support of Squarespace.
Today, I'm really excited to be talking with Una McCormick about her brand new book, The Crimson Shadow, which is the second book in the Fall series, which will be 5 novels when it's complete. And this one centers around the Federation and Cardassia and their alliance. Now, part of this book takes place concurrently with David R. George III's first book. And then following that is the fallout on the other half of the book, with the big event that happens that we talked about with David a few weeks ago. And so, Una, first, I just wanted to welcome you back to the show. I love having you on. And I have to say, you know, I'm going to be a bit biased because I really liked this book. And I think that I've read a few, kind of a few reviews. I, you know, when I have to write my own review, I try not to read other people's because I don't want to be influenced. But yeah, a couple of places I saw, and I completely agree with this sentiment, that this book really transcends the genre that it's in, which is tie-in fiction. I think the what you're doing with Cardassia here is really something that you would see in a Brave New World or something like that, a Fahrenheit 451, where you're really trying to get a message across that transcends the medium that you're writing in. And sci-fi really allows you to do that. So I just wanted to first thank you for, I think, making this book even more important for the series, but also just Star Trek in general and really living up to its best principles.
Well, thank you very much. That's a very flattering comparison. So I'll take that. That's absolutely brilliant. Yes, everything seemed to come together with this book. It's a book that I barely remember writing, actually. I remember I sort of wrote it in two sort of great bursts. One before Christmas, I think, and then one. Oh, I must have finished up just after Christmas. I was finishing it up on my birthday, and I remember sitting down to it again after the Christmas break and going, "Oh, I'm sure I've got loads left to do." And then I looked at it and went, "Blimey, this is nearly finished." And I had no memory of writing about 60,000 words. So
wow.
Whatever was happening, it clearly this was a story that had been lurking around in my head or had really done some good subconscious growing, and I just sat down and described what my subconscious was thinking. So I'm really pleased. I think sometimes you just get a feeling that books are going really well and you're being carried along with it. I had the same with Neverending Sacrifice. Brinkmanship was a harder write, I think, because I hadn't been writing Trek for a while. But this one, I don't remember writing it, so She's good. So I'm delighted you enjoyed it.
Yeah, it does seem like this book, that everything, you know, really fits together really well. It fits together with what, you know, you saw in David's book, which is always fantastic when you're reading a series to have things kind of intertwine. And I did kind of wonder, you know, because David mentions in his book, you know, the Enterprise being sent off to Cardassia. And so I knew that part of this book would take place concurrently, which is kind of hard to do. And I loved just in the story, you come up with that, you know what's going to happen to these characters in the sense that something terrible is going to happen to them. They're going to get the news, which happened to Bacco, and it's going to change everything.
Yeah, I knew that was a bit of a risk because it's the first third of my book is you know, concurrent with David. So I thought, you know, am I going to be able to carry the readers with me? You know, they've signed up for this story arc, and what I'm doing is giving them 30,000 words where we don't really go back to the main story at all. We just, you know, we're devoted to a completely different story. What I hoped, and I thought it was very important to the conception of these books, was that the stories themselves in the individual books would have sufficient kind of weight and pace that you're so absorbed in that that's carrying you through. So I thought I'm going to hand in this manuscript and my editor's going to go, you know, we've got to get going on the main story much sooner. But nope, it seemed to work. But it's a third of the book that's before we find out what's happened in David's book. So I can talk spoilers, can't I? I guess.
Definitely, we can talk spoilers. We did with David's book. We're going to do it with each of the authors. We want to give you all free reign to be able to talk specifically about your book. Hopefully, you know, we still hope to have everybody, as many of the authors on afterwards, so you can kind of all talk about the big parts of the story without having to worry about, oh, I can't talk about David's Max book yet because and that hasn't come out. I can't talk about anything that James is going to do because I know I've read it, or, you know, of course, at the end, Dayton, you know. In fact, right now I'm staying away from all the blurbs from Dayton's book because some of them are quite spoilery. And I don't want to know. I'm really enjoying not knowing. And this book, I read the very first blurb that you had come out. Mm. And then I didn't read anything else because I didn't want to know. And I found it much more enjoyable because the story really does have a few surprises in it, which we'll get to throughout the interview, which I thought you did really well. And so
good. I did enjoy writing those.
I bet those were fantastic. So for you, okay, you said this had kind of been percolating in the back of your mind for a while, and you just kind of spilled out this book. So tell me just kind of the genesis of your story when you look back of it. You know, you knew what David was going to do. You knew kind of, okay, the publisher is kind of looking for this Archduke Ferdinand moment, then we're going to kind of carry that forward. Tell me a little bit just about, okay, you're the second book and you kind of have a launch off where you start in the middle of David's book. Mm. How did this come together for you?
I guess there are lots of components. I knew that I've wanted to do a post-war Cardassian novel for some time. So I knew that I wanted to, after Lotus Flower and then little bits of Neverending Sacrifice. You don't really see Cardassia Prime with Neverending Sacrifice. I knew that there was scope for a story there, that if we were going to look at Cardassia Prime again a little while after the Dominion War, there'd be lots to write about, not just about the physical reconstruction, which is one of the themes of the book, but about the social reconstruction as well. So I knew that there was a good story there, and it's kind of been hanging around in my head for some time, actually, since a few years, actually. I knew it would have to be involve a police constable of some kind, police detective, because police stories are good about what police stories do is that they ask you to think about obviously law and order, but also about corruption. What's right, what's wrong? It's a particular kind of thing that I think crime novels do very well. So I'd had this idea of a post-war Cardassian detective for some time. I think I've been reading, there's a crime thriller writer called Philip Kerr who has a character called Bernie Gunter, who's a policeman during the rise of the Nazis. And
oh,
then,
goodness.
And what a brilliant, brilliant, it's one of those premises where you go, damn, I wish I'd thought of that. that's so great. And he did a series of really good novels that he's still working on. Actually, it's gone post-war now.
Okay.
And so Bernie's Through the War and that kind of thing. And I thought, yes, that's a really good source of moral dilemma or complication.
Definitely.
So I sort of roughly had this idea. And then when the idea of the fall came up, and Margaret Clark, the editor, got the five of us signed up, we were sharing around the projects. And we kind of went, well, let's take a ship each. And David obviously really wants to do Deep Space Nine. He's doing, you know, all this work there. And,
oh, definitely.
Yeah, and others, you know, picked up Titan or so on and so on. And it kind of shook down with a kind of looking at me and went, oh, well, it looks like you're going to end up with Picard and Garrick. And I'm going, what a shame.
You know, oh, yeah, that's just terrible.
I'm heartbroken about that. So what a dreadful thing. So I'm gonna have to take the Enterprise to Cardassia Prime. That's going to break my heart. So that was just irresistible. I think because we know Garrick, and we've seen Garrick in operation with Sisko, who he's able to just wind up incredibly easily and get a reaction.
Well, and what a great dynamic. I mean, the
exactly.
fact, because
yeah.
they can kind of go toe-to-toe in a completely
yeah.
different way than you get, you know, Picard and Garrick going toe-to-toe.
Exactly, yeah. With Picard,
yeah.
you feel that Garrick has got someone who's genuinely an intellectual equal, kind of
right.
a cerebral, as well-read. It's a different kind of intelligence. Garrick's is very dynamic and on the fly, and I think that Picard's intelligence mm-hmm. is very considered and measured, very
right.
reflective. But these are two people who are intelligent enough to have the measure mm-hmm. of each other and quite a sophisticated measure of each other. And
and talking about the Sisko and Garrick dynamic, you know, you kind of have two guys who I think their loyalty to their people and to their principles is quite the same. You know, Sisko is
yeah.
completely sold out to the Federation and its ideals, and we see that throughout the series. You know, Garrick is completely sold out to his belief in the Cardassians, but in a way that doesn't mirror his people anymore. You know, he's got a new idea of what they should be, and that plays out throughout this book. And I thought that was really interesting because you get that dynamic of these two guys who really do believe in their people. And the best of their people, and sometimes willing to do whatever it takes for their people. And so for me, Garrick and Sisko were always mirrors for each other.
Yeah.
And Picard and Garrick are a very different type of mirror for each other. And I loved that interplay.
Thank you. Good. I was really pleased. I think there's a great deal of antagonism between Sisko and Garrick. And I think it's to do with that mirroring. That Sisko fears that he
yes.
has the capacity to be Garrick, which, as we
yes.
discover, he does. And Garrick is almost goading him into this. And there's, you know, there's quite a lot of physical violence between, you know, he
yes.
really punches the lights out of him. But Picard, it's completely different. Picard, it's almost like Picard is the challenger in that relationship. It's Garrick that has to live up to Picard's cautious offer of friendship.
Right.
And I think Garrick wants Picard's respect, whereas I don't think he wants Sisko's respect. I don't think he respects Sisko. So it was a really, really interesting pair of people to put together, and interesting to put them. They have to work together, but the you know, Picard is obviously suspicious. I mean, you know, Picard has very good reasons not to feel comfortable around Cardassians. And to have to, particularly, you know, having been tortured by Cardassians and having to deal with
yes.
a man that he knows has been a torturer, it involves a lot of self-control. I mean, Picard is very good at self-control. So so when I was kind of given the assignment of Picard and Garrick, it's like, oh, I'm going to struggle. Oh, I'm going to have to really,
definitely.
You know, sit down and be miserable with this. So, I was thrilled to bits to get that. And then that became the kind of core of the book, I think, that play between them. And I don't think they are antagonistic at any point. I think it is two men trying to work together, but obviously
definitely.
Having loyalties to, you know, Picard has specific loyalties to the new president, to Starfleet, to the Federation, and finds himself in a situation where his allies are not so allied after all. Yeah,
exactly. Well, and what was great about it, I thought, too, was that, one, you could tell in their interactions, I feel like you can tell that Picard has read probably Sisko's reports on Garak, and that's one of the reasons that he's so trepidatious about this. You know, he moving very cautiously. And two, you could see that Picard, at the same time, has some of those Sisko characteristics where he's willing to break the rules, take the chance, be that kind of Kirk type character where he's going to do what he feels is best. And Picard really pulled that off in this book for me, of being that that diplomat and that cowboy all at the same time, which is probably, I think, as Picard has grown up in the books, and David has really taken him this way, David Mack, Picard has become more of the cowboy in his later years, I think, because of his love of family, his finding out what's really important, and having that change happen. I think it's been really good because he's still the Picard we love, but he's added this other layer that I think makes him one of the greatest captains we've ever seen, I think now, more so than he was in the series or in the movies. Just really love that character more so than I ever did, you know, when he was on screen.
Yeah, I mean, he's obviously quite stiff in the show, and I mean, he's performed that way. Is it Ian Forster who says, if it was a choice between betraying my friends or betraying my country, I hope I'd have the guts to betray my country? I think it's Forster. I might be forgetting this. And I think this is where Picard's narrative has gone. And you're absolutely right that the minute that there's family, that complicates where his loyalties will lie. This is why dystopias always try and get rid of family ties, because they, you know, they want loyalty to the state. So the minute that's there, I think Picard suddenly has more claims on his emotions, his desires, his loyalties. So it's very subtly done, and I think that was. But at the same time, he's a Starfleet man. You know, this is a man who's absolutely committed to this organization. Of course, Starfleet's been a bit, certainly in the books, it's been a little bit grayer than it has been in the past.
Exactly.
Well, and when we last saw him in Brinkmanship, he was, you know, treading a fine line with various things that were going on.
Well, I think it's made him a better captain, personally. I really think family has taken him and making him a better captain, because he does have more than just duty and honor to live for. And there's something about, and you talk about this, and I want to get into it later, but you do this thing with the idea of love, and how it can either be a really big asset or it can twist and destroy into something, you know, disgusting, which we get, you know, racism and xenophobia and all those kind of things from. And so for Picard, I think his love for family has increased his love for peace and freedom and the Federation and fighting for what's right. And that's really where that's taken him, and I think it made him a better character.
Yeah. Whereas before, the institution would not be sufficient. It would be it would be constraining his love in a way. It's much more rule bound, or it's not a sufficient thing to love an institution. You've got to love the people who make that institution up, which I put in the book.
Exactly. Yeah. It's
oh
man. Yeah, it's so good. Well, okay. So I kind of wanted to move a little bit this way. You know, David does the Archduke Ferdinand moment, and we talked a little bit about him with how history is kind of influencing, you know, our history is influencing the storyline here. Now, for you, I felt like there were quite a few real world influences on your book, and I would just, I saw quite a few of them. What were some of the ones that you used for this book?
Oh, well, absolutely post-war Europe. That's post-war Germany. I mean, in the back of my mind, that's always, and we're presented with this on screen, I think. We're given the Cardassians as Nazis, and we're given the Dominion War as World War II, because it's the generation of writers who are writing Deep Space Nine are processing the experiences of perhaps parents or grandparents who fought in World War II, probably grandparents. So, I mean, we're given Cardassia in the Dominion War as Germany and World War II. So, and this ties in with what I was saying about, you know, thinking about the Philip Kerr novels, the Bernie Gunter novels. So it was always the reconstruction of Germany that I had in mind, this process of what do you do when you've got a country that you've destroyed, you've beaten in war. How do you reconstruct this when you're looking at a country and going, but all the people that we have here are in some way, to a greater or lesser degree, implicated with what has happened? Well, first of all, you've got to sort out the real criminals, you know, the psychopaths, the murderers. You've got to find these people and punish them. And at the same time, you have to go through, the word they use, denazification. You've got to find everyone who is in the middle levels and go, well, what processes went wrong here? Who is culpable of holding a gun and firing it and actually killing people? But how do we think through guilt and culpability and responsibility through something, through a big institution, through a big social group? And that takes a lot of reflection, a lot of commitment from the people on the ground, a lot of courage, I think, from a lot of post-war Germans to kind of go, well, you know, we've got to accept what happened here and commit to having it not happen ever again. And Germany, of course, turns out to be extremely successful. It's got a few problems at the moment, I think, with kind of coping with Turkish immigrants and so on, but obviously nothing on the scale of what we're seeing in Greece. So that was obviously a model. And then the other thing I think that was in my mind was precisely this, the kind of things that are happening in the sort of as the European Union's under strain at the moment because of the recession, these resurgence of far-right parties that we're seeing. So I was imagining a Cardassia that was at a sort of pressure point moment. It's done a lot of good work. We're about 10 years after the Dominion War now. It's done a lot of good work, but the chance or the possibility of regression is there. And you could imagine this happening very easily, that people would go, well, how long, you know, I wasn't involved in this war. I didn't do any of these things. How long am I going to have to be expected to carry the can? You know, I was 12 years old, or I was 15. I wasn't even in the army. I was just bombed, and you know, my parents were shot by Jem Hadar. So why am I being punished? And of course, these people would be in their 20s now, so they'd be becoming political actors. And if there's poverty, which there might still be, then that would provide the kind of breeding ground for a new kind of nationalism. So it was that combination of reflecting on post-war Europe and reflecting on what's currently happening, particularly in places like Greece, and thinking, well, let's think what these pressures are and let's think them through and what kind of solutions people might try, somebody like Eric might try, to prevent Cardassia going nationalist again. So I guess those were the real world examples that I had in mind. Yeah, I think they're pretty clear. You know, you can see Germany in there. Yeah, yeah.
Well, and I was thinking.
Oh, we also have a bit of far right stuff in Britain at the moment. So I was sort of purging myself. And then there are a few jokes for British readers who will recognise some of our news broadcasters and that kind of thing. So you pick up whatever's current, you pick it up and you stick it in, I think.
One of the things that I thought was really great is that you know, I saw that that idea of, you know, Germany and its decision. And so for me, though, I was thinking actually between, you know, Germany after World War One, which obviously, you know, David had used the beginning of World War One. So I was thinking it was, you know, it's a combination of Germany when they get the Treaty of Versailles and the Germany after World War Two, kind of a combination of those two, because you're really dealing with this Cardassia first is very much, again, this Nazi-ish type of regime who wants, and then, of course, this big spoiler that behind all of this is this Cardassian true way that the Obsidian Order was created to help, you know, keep a check on. And very much this idea that this thread in these people is going to keep coming back. Which, you know, you get into in the book a lot of sociology and the ideas of, is there something inherently bad about Cardassians that keeps twisting this idea of love for their homeland, love for their people, you know, a love for the fatherland, the motherland is has been called in our world over and over again into racism and overpowering nationalism. And I thought that that was really important because anytime that's happened in any place in the world, it has not turned out well here on Earth. And obviously playing out for the Cardassians, it's never turned out well. And you keep having, for the Cardassians, they're once more kind of the quote unquote bad guys. They're trying to make a change in their society, and yet their society is stuck in this loop of keep doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result, which is crazy.
Never ending sacrifice.
Exactly. And so now they're definitely, I think, in that push of like that, say, post-World War II Germany, we have to be different, because if we keep doing the same things over and over again, our society is just going to be crushed. It will be dead. It will be gone.
We're going to be dead. We'll eat ourselves. We'll be the, you know, we'll drop bombs on each other, and that will be the end. So that was really the kind of the moral dilemma I want. And it's natural, I think. You know, we love the things that are around us. They're familiar. They're safe. They're the things we know. They're the things we've learnt from. And I think as anybody who's in a sort of abusive situation knows, sometimes you love things that are not good for you. I think this works at a social level. You know, sometimes the world that you're comfortable and safe in is actually broken in some way. It isn't good for you. It's forcing you and other people in a bad direction. It's giving you it's making you materialist, or it, you know, it makes you chop down rainforests or something, or covet the new iPad or something like that. And these are all lovely and they're very comforting, but they're not necessarily a great plan for a sort of a healthy future. So things that are very close to us we can love, but we can love them uncritically, I think. And to maintain a love for something, but to be prepared to sort of say, but I my part of my love of it is my ability to let it go, to let it change, to let it blossom. And I think that's the journey that Garrick has taken. He stops being protective and starts to be able to say, well, if I keep holding Cardassia to myself in this way, it will be extinct, and that's not what I want. I want it alive. He lets Cardassia go in a strange way whilst becoming a Castellan. Poor Garrick is a man of constant sort of different pulls on him, contradictions.
Well, and what was great is that, you know, Garrick is the personal representation of what's going to need to happen globally on Cardassia, you know, because Garrick has also been somebody who's been stuck in this cycle of kind of doing the same things over and over again and hoping that he'll get a different result personally for his life, and realizing, I think, and this was kind of the beauty is how you can learn from, you know, different people you wouldn't think would teach you. You know, I think he's learned from his relationship, say, with Julian, and his interactions with Sisko, and now his interactions you see with somebody like Picard. He's learned a different way. And that it's okay to say, we don't know it all. And Cardassians like to be know-it-alls. And Garrick's a great picture of that. He seems to know everything. And yet, in some ways, he knows nothing. And I think he's been able to say, I don't know everything, and I can learn from somebody else. And we as Cardassians can learn from somebody else. And we have to be able to move into this kind of alliance. We have to be able to survive. You know, we can't be isolationists and think that we are the best. And I think that's a really beautiful thing. And it just mirrors every single part of life, from personal to country to global. It's a big subject, and I think it's an important one, and definitely one that we'll all be facing probably forever, because it's a constant struggle.
And it's learning humility, I guess. You know, Garrick always has to have the last word, or, you know, he always has to be the smartest one in the room, the one with the special knowledge. Cardassia thinks that it's culturally superior to everyone around it. And so that kind of, ideally you would learn this in a much less punishing way, but to sit amongst the ruins of your civilization and go, well, that superiority thing hasn't worked out so well, takes a particular kind of courage. And I think Garrick is courageous. I mean, he's brutal and he's misguided often, and he's mistaken very often, but he is courageous, I think. So, you know, pull myself together. How can I make Cardassia survive? Let's start by not killing people.
Right. It's the way in which suffering can teach and mold, and, you know, a very scriptural Christianity type idea that suffering puts you through the fire and you come out refined. You know, that's how gold is made, you know, and that's how better people are made, is that if we take that suffering that a lot of times we put our own selves through because of our bad choices, and we learn. And the best way, you know, this was a beautiful discussion in the book. How do you remake the soul? And how do you remake the Cardassian soul specifically? And the answer is to learn from the past and make a change for the future. And it's so true for our own lives, as well as, you know, on a national scale or a global scale, that the only way to move forward is to not, you know, the famous saying, you know, you're doomed to repeat the past if you don't learn from it. And Cardassians have been doing that. And so
I'm a very, very lapsed Catholic. I'm a very ex-Catholic, but I found thematically that something that I've thought about quite a lot is this idea of original sin. Which is quite a horrible idea. When you know, it can kind of go two ways. You can think that's a horrible idea, that we're all kind of born flawed, you know, and there's something that we can't escape. But at the same time, I think that a character like Garrick has sort of found that a notion like that quite comforting. That there is no perfection. You can strive for perfect action. You're never going to manage it, but you can do the best that you can. Best that you can in the situation, and strive for something, and not just cynically fall back onto cruelty or judgment or control. So, so I've been reflecting on that concept quite a lot, because you know, even if you stop believing in God and stop going to mass, you're still a Catholic culturally. So, this idea is something that I've been reflecting on quite a bit recently. And I think you end up being a bit, certainly with a character like Garrick, I think it's if you kind of try and splice a concept like that on him, it gives him a sense of humility. I'm never going to be superior. I'm never going to be the best person here. And that learning that lesson, I think, is an important corrective to his nationalism, his superiority complex. So there was a little bit of that in there as well, I suspect.
Well, and for me, you know, on that vein of that kind of spiritual idea, you know, the Cardassian people aren't known for their spirituality, but they have this kind of, I think, warped sense again of love, and that they've put all of their love into something that's really temporal, which is their love of country and their love of institutions, instead of what we then move forward in this book, which I thought was brilliant, is the idea of the love of the people inside the institution. It's not the institution that matters, it's the people inside. And that's a very, again, Catholic Christianity type idea, that we don't love the temporal, what doesn't matter. We love the eternal, that there is something eternal.
That's really interesting, because I think that's coming straight from my humanism. That's, you know, there's nothing beyond this that we can love, so for the love of the God I don't believe in, we've got to love each other. So that seems real humanism to me. That's really interesting. We can't love something supernatural or extra temporal. We've just got to love what we've got here. And you know, try and put up with each other.
Well, and
really interesting.
Yeah, because, you know, for me on my side, it's that because I know that people are eternal, it's them that matter, not everything else, you know. And
because I know that they're ephemeral, that's why they matter. But this is where we find common ground.
Exactly.
I mean, from a different starting point, you find a kind of common morality. I think it's really interesting.
Right. And I think that's the kind of the beauty that we are seeing here in the book, is that a place like Cardassia and Garak, a character you wouldn't ever think of, are finding common ground with somebody like the Federation, where they've had two completely different types of ideas, and yet they are finding that it's really in the commonality, it's really in the people are what's important. And if we're looking for the greatest good for the best number of people, that's really the idea of the Federation, is to do the best good for the most amount.
And it's one that you really have to wrestle with. I think when I'm writing Star Trek, it's very easy. Or one thing that I consistently want to challenge is the Federation as the vessel of complete good. I think this is partly because of being a British viewer of an American show. So partly you're watching something which is kind of presenting to you a set of very American values. And you're going, well, these don't quite match on to culturally what I think. You know, there's a lot of overlap. Mm-hmm. So and simultaneously, there's a lot of danger of cultural imperialism, which Next Gen begins to interrogate, and then DS9 obviously interrogates. So you're sort of grappling with that. And I think Cardassia is a very, very good arena to examine the cultural imperialism of the Federation, or, you know, how good or bad the Federation is, or how much Cardassia wants to take. Because Cardassia, in my mind, would never enter the Federation. It wouldn't join the Federation. It wouldn't. It would always remain Cardassia. But it would be changed by its encounter with the Federation. So it's an interesting dynamic to look at. What do these very different cultures take from each other? And is there something universal, a set of values that they can share, a few ideas that they can share, even though they're very, very different. So that's why I love. We're back to the mirroring again, aren't we? So we're back to sort of Sisko and Garak and Picard and Garak, Cardassia and the Federation mirroring each other as a utopia and a dystopia, and what they can do in connection with each other. So. Very rich.
Oh,
good,
definitely.
Subject matter. Well, I'm looking to do this stuff.
It's one of those things too, like you kind of see for, you know, somebody, people who want to get married, if they're really thinking about marriage, they're realizing that, okay, to really be compatible with somebody, you need the same values you need the same basis for values too, to really help you move forward. It's been interesting to watch the novels kind of take the Federation and Cardassia, and kind of, especially in this book, watch the Cardassians kind of move their values for freedom and democracy and free speech and all those things, and have them move towards a more Federation type ideal without losing what makes them Cardassian.
And at the same time, you've got a character like the character that I put in, who's the head of the mission there. For want of a better word, Margaret Fry, she's sort of the voice of saying, well, you know, I'm Federation, I've been here a long time, let me tell you what's good about Cardassia. You know, it's dogged, it doesn't give up, it carries on beyond the apocalypse, it carries on. People just go, okay, we have to build. And that has always seemed a very interesting aspect of Cardassian culture to me, a very resource-poor world that simultaneously makes them quite brutal and imperialist, but at the same time gives them a sort of capacity for invention or survival or doggedness, and a tendency not to give up. So I think she's the voice of the a Federation person saying, here's what we can learn from Cardassia, and keeping on after the apocalypse is one of them. not giving up, carrying on.
Well, and the idea of the that Garak takes from the book that he gives to Picard, the Crimson Shadow, which is that that's the beauty he takes from that book, is that Cardassia will continue, because Cardassia isn't going to be the one that conquers. Cardassia is going to be the one that gets conquered. And I thought that that was a beautiful juxtaposition for the storyline, and that's what really helped remake Garak's soul, was that he saw the devastation of his own people and what had gotten them there, which was that idea that we are better than everybody else, so therefore we deserve to rule everybody else.
Yeah.
And that can't be the answer.
And his personal complicity in all of this as well.
Exactly. Exactly. And he, in very much a way, and I think this is maybe where your latent Catholicism came in, was, I may have just named the show Latent Catholicism. was that he is serving penance at this point. He feels very much as if he will spend the rest of his life serving Cardassia, because that's his way of repaying the galaxy for the evil that he has perpetrated on it.
And it is his evil. It is his crime. He's the one standing on that ship with Tane that tries to destroy the Founder's home world, and that's where it all starts. No, I think you're right, and it's a real Catholic penance as well, isn't it? It's not going up into onto a hillside and getting down on his knees and praying. It's real grace by good works, isn't it?
So, exactly.
You know, I've got to atone by not retreating from the world, but getting stuck in there and doing all the dog work of sorting out a water supply or dealing with the idiots in the assembly and not strangling them or having them shot. So, yeah, it's a real justification by works, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah, latent Catholicism. Just can't help myself.
Well, hey, it's okay. I think it is the power of the idea of religion, that it's hard to take away. Even if you don't end up believing in it, it has a lot of powerful motifs, which is one of the reasons that they kind of stick around. I mean, you know, the greatest stories tend to kind of reflect a biblical story of lots of times either redemption or ultimate sacrifice. Of those things, they become a really important deal. It's what Tolkien talks about in the idea of eucatastrophe, have the story get to its worst point until the turning point becomes a happy accident or a happy turn of events out of the darkest turn of events. And so it's pretty beautiful. So, well, I wanted to give you a chance to just kind of talk about, you know, you get to write Picard and Garak. Just tell me about what it's like to have these master wordsmiths and negotiators kind of go at it.
Well, part of you goes, I hope I can do them justice. And then the other part of you goes, oh, this is going to be brilliant. Let's just let loose on this. And they did surprise me with the sort of quickness with which they struck up a friendship, I think. I wonder if I was suspecting a lot more antagonism between them. Mm-hmm. But they do very rapidly work together, and the tensions really come between Garak, are between the men and their direct superiors. So you sort of have Picard dealing with a difficult new president, and then obviously Garak with this difficult relationship that he has with his head of state, who doesn't trust him, and for very good reasons. I liked this idea of there being a kind of compatriotism, or fellowship between them, that was easier than their relationship with their heads of state or their direct superiors. And whether this is down to I think you always know you're amongst friends if you walk into somebody's house and you see the big bookshelf and you go, oh, a reader of books. We've got common ground here, and they are readers and they are reflectors, I think that's where they find some of their common ground. And I think Garak wants Picard's respect I'm not sure if Picard wants Garrick's respect, but I think he's gratified to have it. I haven't quite thought that one through. So, I mean, partly you were a little bit afraid that you'd get them wrong, particularly someone like Picard, who's so iconic and people have written really well. Garrick, I felt on safer ground with because he just seems to possess me and then make me do his bidding whenever I write him. So, but at the same time, you want to validate or acknowledge or work with and respect stuff that other people have done. So there's a lot of Andy Robinson's book in here. I reread Stitch in Time very, very closely before I wrote this. So there's a lot of reflection on that as well. You want to make it feel congruent. So I just seized the opportunity. Unfortunately, I didn't get. Maybe I didn't, panic about it and think, "Oh my God, I've got to get this right." They just did the talking really and struck this friendship up that was a lot stronger and a lot quicker than I'd anticipated. I thought there'd be a lot more sparring, but in fact, they rapidly become simpatico.
Well, and that's something that I loved, that conversation that they have, Picard, saying, I can't be involved in the removal of a democratically elected leader of another government. And Garrick says, no. Why, Captain, you're no fun at all. Sisko would have been willing. And he says, well, yes, I'm not Benjamin Sisko, which I loved because that's exactly what Sisko got to say to Q, which is, well, I'm not Picard. And the difference between these two men, and earlier you had said you weren't sure if you thought that Garrick respected Sisko, and I think I don't know. I even think in your own book here, I think Garrick reflects that he does respect Sisko, but for different reasons than he respects Picard. And then he realizes the very big difference between these two men, and yet they are going about it the same way, like they or they're looking for the same end results. They just might not always do it the same way. And I always thought that that was the difference between all of the captains that we see in Star Trek, is that a lot of times they each had their own individualistic way of going towards the same results. Whether it was, Archer, Picard, Sisko, Janeway, or Kirk, they were all trying to get to the same place, but they all had their own unique ways of doing it. And that's what made them all so lovable to so many people. And you love them for different things. And it's either where they differ or where they are in sync that you get those kind of places where you're like, okay, I can really latch on to Sisko, or I can really latch on to Janeway. And so I really like that you bringing that up in the book, because it is true. These guys are different, and they have different ways of doing things, but they are all looking towards, hopefully, I mean, you see them all looking towards, we're working towards the same kind of future. We just might go about it a little bit differently. So.
And Picard does a fair amount of rule bending in this book as well. He did part of the jokes at the end is that even with the shutdown, you've got this Federation base just overrun with Cardassians. All they've done through the lockdown is beam Cardassians into the base. And that's a rule that Picard is letting them bend. And then, obviously his conversations with the car at the very end about how far they can let this piece of information go and about the true way and when they should release it upwards is a fairly tough decision to make, and not certainly by no means the letter of the law. So he's rule bending as well. I think Garrick gets Sisko to bend rules to Garrick's advantage, and from that learns that he should not do this with Picard, that manipulating Picard would be a disaster. But saying to Picard, I need you to do these things for the sake of an alliance and a kind of a future good, Picard, you can negotiate with us. This is exactly what you do with Picard. You negotiate. You assume that he's a rational man that you can make your case to if your case is good enough. And of course, Garrick is very good at getting people to do what he wants. He's just got to work out the best way of doing it. And he sees that with Picard, it's honesty and negotiation.
Well, and you have that great scene at the end where Picard is quote unquote dressing down Worf, and he says, that is indeed what I worded the instructions, number one. Yeah. Nevertheless, I hope that neither of you will do anything of this sort again. And of course, she says, well, of course not, sir. Sorry, sir. And Worf just folds his arms and says nothing. Until next time, of course, says Picard.
Exactly.
At which you can just see the gleam in Patrick Stewart's eye at that point in the scene, that where and the way that he would say it in that wonderful British, quote unquote British French that he is. You know, just but until next time, and a really, I think a very kind of Kirk line for him to be able to say, which I loved. Giving him that Picard has become a man. He knows when to bend the rules and when it's appropriate.
Yes.
Because sometimes, you know, as Kirk would say, you don't have to break the rules. You just have to bend them before they break.
And to be besotted with the rules is not congruent, I think, with the rest of what the book is saying, which is, you know, institutions don't have their own morality. It's the choices that you make as you call those institutions into being that make them moral. So hopefully that's a kind of small scale version of you know, a bigger theme of the book.
Well, and those institutions, morality has to come from the eternal nature of the people inside them, because right and wrong aren't institutionalized by an institution. They are what transcends that institution for all people. And I think that's kind of a big thing that we kind of get from this book as well. Like, we have to, as a people, figure out what is best for us, what is right, what is wrong, and then institute those into our institutions, not have it the other way around.
Yeah. As a humanist and a sociologist, I'd say, well, we make our morality as we act and live together. It's in that kind of contract or interaction with each other that we come into being as moral actors, as moral agents. So, but I think there's common ground here. So it's not just trusting that the rules will always give you the answer. Mm-hmm. Rules are good. They're good as guidelines, but, you know, they don't always work in the moment. So, no, I enjoyed that scene. That was fun to write, you know, just a bit of...
Well, a few more things. One was, I noticed it's very current, this idea that instability and mistrust are the things that are used by enemies of freedom most often to get into power. And sadly, it seems they don't really have to work that hard with the corruption that flows out of the governments. And it's this corruption that almost destroys Cardassia again of... you know, being implicit in this act of you know, killing the Federation president. And but the fact then that the government itself is corrupt enough so that the leader of Cardassia finds out about it later and then won't tell or confess to her allies that, look, our people have been involved in this. We want you to help us take care of this. You know, that mistrust, that corruption, that fear is what they all prey on. And it's kind of sad, you know, that really in the end, even our best governments today have the same problem. We find out about this kind of corruption all the time, and it doesn't take much for our enemies to gain power in places, whether it's, you know, politically in a place like, you know, in Syria or any of those kind of places where we're watching these kind of things happen, they're able to gain power because they say we have a better way.
And there's extraordinary sort of extraordinary cynicism in them. I don't want to fall into the trap of going, it was all better in the good old days, because, you know, there's a lot about modern society that's much better than the good old days, but extraordinary cynicism in political culture in Britain and in America as well. I think this whole nonsense of the Senate blocking your budget and this kind of thing. It's come on, guys, you can't, you know, there are people who need government services that this is going to affect. They're going to be hungry, or they're not going to have money, they're not going to get paid. And it seemed a cynical move. A great deal of cynicism in British politics, a sense of antagonism between the major parties, and even between coalition partners. We've got a coalition government at the moment, and you can see that announcements are made to spite the other member of the coalition, or the leader of the other party or whatever. And it there doesn't seem to be a consensus politics has its limits, and I think you can get a kind of monoculture from it. But the antagonism of political culture in Britain, in particular, at the moment, isn't getting anyone anywhere, I think. And it's a sort of it reduces it to a kind of playground game. And you think, well, you know, you've got to be thinking about concretely solving problems and putting your case for solving these problems. And I think a politician who had the nerve to do that and to start speaking in that way would find a great desire for that amongst British voters, that people would listen to that, because people just cannot see what this kind of politics is achieving. It just looks like playground games. So there was a little bit of that, and I deliberately put that into my villain in the book is probably a bit of a caricature, but then a lot of politicians look like caricatures to me at the moment. He gets a grilling from one of our one of the scenes in the book is kind of directly lifted from one of our news programs, and there's a guy that, if you know British news programs, you'll recognize as one of the interviewers. So I did have a little bit of fun with that, but I think there's a sort of vapidity to political culture at the moment, which at its worst gives scope for the demagogues and the bad people to come through and say simple things that people want to hear, but without actual concrete proposals for change or growth. So I'm quite frustrated with them. I think a lot of people are quite frustrated with political culture in Britain. Yeah. and I dare say in America as well. And that has its own danger, because you sort of see a public figure in Britain the past week, a guy called Russell Brand. He's a comedian of sorts. Had a very high profile interview on one of our flagship news programs, basically saying, "Oh, there's no point of voting. You know, why would anyone do this?" And you listen to this and you go, "Well, that's symptomatic of something." I think he's got a lot of kudos for, you know, telling it as it is. But you listen to that and you think, well, no, that's not good. Not voting is at the very least, use your vote, you know, and ideally find some other kind of political participation that's meaningful. So he's got a lot of kudos, but for me, it's symptomatic of something that's not quite right or quite bad, actually, about political culture. Anyway, so I put a fair bit of that into the book as well, because I think I was grumpy about it at the time. Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, and there's definitely some great commentary just about the idea of the 24-hour news cycles that we have now, and the good and the bad of it, the frustration that comes along with everybody thinking that they're an expert just because they have a Twitter or a blog, and this whole idea that, you know, free speech is a fantastic and amazing gift that we have, but it's a gift. It's not a right. You know, we don't have a right to free speech. We gift it to each other, and to use it wisely.
Technically, of course, you do have a right to free speech.
Yes, we do in America.
Yeah.
Yes, but it's also But it's also, I think, it's a gift that we give each other, you know, and we misuse it all the time to say really hurtful, hateful things all over the place, whether it's the way that people ridiculously bash celebrities on Twitter, or the way that celebrities ridiculously bash politicians, or way the 24-hour news cycle creates this whole dystopia of information, because they don't really have the information as they give it to you, because they don't have the full information, because they have to immediately give you something. Ugh.
It's a weird old world, 24-hour news. I read something recently that says, oh, you know, it actually has physiological effects on you, the kind of the way that it repeats news and the way that it kind of builds up and then climaxes a story and sort of brings it down, actually has negative physiological effects on you. It can contribute to depression and anxiety. I stopped listening to the news. I stopped, 24-hour news I gave up on years ago, and I don't I don't actually watch news broadcasts anymore, unless specifically I want to make myself angry about something.
Exactly.
I'll turn on the news. I'm feeling like I want to feel a bit angry. I'm going to turn the news on. So, very poor quality of and a sort of Twitter I adore. I like very, very much. But there's this cycle of outrage that you see, and mm-hmm. People are very angry about something one day. And then 2 days later, you go, weren't we all angry about that the other day?
Yeah, but, exactly.
Yeah, and people are getting a funny conception of free speech as well. I think, and you see this a lot with journalists on Twitter, where they say something, and then the part of Twitter that doesn't agree with them goes, well, I don't think that's right. And then the journalists get terribly upset and go, whoa, you're bullying me. This is free speech. It's my right to... And yet you kind of watch this sort of thing unfold. You go, well, journalists in the past probably haven't been used to this sort of degree of response. And actually what they're seeing is free speech. They're publishing their article and people are saying, well, that's rubbish. And they're going, oh, this has never happened to me before. You know, usually I publish my article and
right.
I just get my, my mates going, that was brilliant. But no, now actually you've got a responsive public. Mm-hmm. So we have some interesting things going on. I think people think that if they say something and somebody disagrees, that's not having your free speech infringed. That's free speech in operation. That's somebody
right,
saying,
exactly.
I don't agree. Yeah. And we are all perfectly within our rights to not agree with each other. So, Twitter's really interesting.
I think it really shows, there was a point in the book where you're talking about, look, you said at first it was a Bajoran, now it was the Zenkethi, and now we think it's us, the Cardassians. And how this kind of 24-hour news cycle really perpetrates this whole thing of we report things before we actually have all the information, and so things get misreported instead of wisely piecing the story together and then having it come out when it's full, when we have the actual story. We just kind of have half truths and half stories all the time, and this is what people I think get so frustrated about. I'm with you. I stopped watching the news because it's not worth it, because they're not telling me anything. Better when we had the newspaper, when it would have to come out every day and they would have to track down all the stories, and they wouldn't release the story until it was finished.
And on
when
the
they
plus
had
side, you
more the
you
full
get to
story
triangulate your own news now. I mean, I pick up information mm-hmm. from multiple sources and assemble what
That's
I think
true.
Is the
yep.
so you kind of it makes you more responsible as a citizen in that way, that you have to work out exactly what's going on. So
exactly.
And not just rely on the BBC or Fox or Huffington Post or whatever. You kind of assemble things. I think as well that the speed of response, mean people feel like they should be getting punishment or catharsis immediately. And some of the most mm-hmm. courageous actions I've seen online are where, something happens in an organization, an online organization. People are very angry. They demand punishment. They demand blood. And the people who are running the organization go, no. We're going to go through what's happened here. We're taking your concerns very carefully. We all need to speak
yep.
together, see what's happened, and make a decision about that. And that could take up to maybe a week or a fortnight even.
Right.
And people are, but people need this sort of, they need the story to have ended that day. They need the perpetrator to be punished that day so that they can move on to the next thing, which doesn't necessarily serve everyone very well. So, we live in interesting times, Matthew.
That we do. Well, Una, I wanted to just see, what is next for you? What will you be working on next? And what could our readers be looking for there? And then, of course, too, where can they, find you online and to be able to interact? Obviously, we talked about Twitter a little bit. But, what's mm-hmm. that stuff that's coming up for you that we can be excited about?
Well, I mean, my immediate priority is, as you know, is that my first baby is due quite soon. So that's going to take
yes.
up quite a lot of my energy and creative spark for the next 18 or 20 or 30 years, I think. So that's looming quite soon for me. I have, in the meantime, I've sort of been storing up a bank of stuff. that will be coming out over the next year or so. Not all of that has been announced yet, so I'll keep some of that under my hat. But there will be, whilst I'm busy with nappies and colic, there will be stuff coming out, so it will look like I'm productive. I will plug a book that's out at the moment, which is called Middle Earth Envisioned. It's edited,
Okay.
sorry, it's written by Paul Simpson and Brian J. Robb, and it's a beautiful book. It's about adaptations of Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit
Okay.
for film and radio and stage, and a handful of us were invited to sort of do short essays for that
Oh,
book. So
excellent.
I've got a short essay in that about the radio and TV treatment of Denethor and his sons.
Okay.
So that came out this week. It's a beautiful book, a coffee table book, a beautiful cover, gold, with little sort of gold things on. I'm very
Oh,
pleased with the
wow.
essay I've got in it. I'm really looking forward to seeing that. And I've read the manuscript. It's a super book. So I think people would enjoy that. What else is happening? Oh, I've got some academic essays that I've been working on about fan fiction and Tolkien fan fiction. So
Oh, okay.
they should
Wow.
pop up. Yeah, but hopefully next year you'll have a sense of me being published and productive, when really I'll be without sleep.
Exactly. And embroiled in all sorts of fun domestic endeavors. So,
Yeah, it's gonna be interesting.
well, just want to thank you so much for coming on. It's always so much fun to get to talk to you. We always end up talking about, I think, just a great many things beyond Star
Yeah,
Trek
I
and
always really enjoy it. Yeah.
So we really appreciate that. We cannot wait for your next Star Trek book to come out and to be able to talk to you then. And hopefully we will be able to have as many people as possible from the fall be able to come on and talk to us once Dayton's book is officially released and we've gotten a chance to talk to him about that and let you guys just go at it and because this is a really big series for Star Trek. It's been a while, I think, since a series like this has been done.
Yeah.
And it's going to have massive repercussions. I think we're all going to want to talk about it once it's finally complete,
Yeah.
and get all the background information. So, thank you so
Exactly.
much for being here.
Absolutely my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me on. I always really enjoy speaking to you, so thanks.
Well, Matthew, that was a great interview with Una, and I'm really sorry that I missed out on it. But as we've talked about before on here, it's really hard when we try to coordinate Texas and the UK and Japan and get all those time zones working together. But I'm really glad that with everything she has going on, she was able to put some time aside for you anyway to talk about the book.
It was a lot of fun, Chris. I always enjoy when we do have Una on, and I mean, we after the interview, we were both talking about how we could probably go on for quite a while, just continuing to talk. And so it's what's nice about having her on is it really is just a continuous flow of conversation. And so had a wonderful time, and it is really a fantastic book. So I was very pleased that we were able to get her on and be able to talk about the book, before her life gets really too busy. So.
Most definitely. And I'm looking forward to continuing on through the fall with the other three books as they come out and talking to everyone about those as well. So, as interesting as that interview with Una was, Matthew, it's not the only thing we've been talking about here on the network this week. So, here are some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Orb.
Time travel and alternate realities.
And then you have everybody else on the Defiant that we, obviously don't know very well, but they all have somebody that's going to be affected. And then you think, too, oh goodness, the whole entire Dominion War would have been affected if they hadn't gone back.
Earl Grey.
Episodes we love to defend.
In the observation lounge, and he accidentally calls him number one, and then they look at each other like, is he going to figure it out? And I'm thinking, what do the Ferengi know? They don't know anything. They're not like, wait, let me look that up. Wait, that means something that Captain Picard calls his first. No, they don't know that.
The Ready Room.
Relics.
In the day, I asked Ron about it, and he said, we just screwed up. I screwed up. Producer screwed up. Mike and Rick. And it wouldn't be Andre then. It would have been Nerain as the science advisor. It's like nobody caught it.
To the journey.
5-episode marathon.
Yeah, with Aisha Tyler and Jeri Ryan, she talked about how when she signed up and actually signed the contract to become 7 of 9, she'd never seen the show before, but she watched an episode of Star Trek Voyager as she went home that night and was aired, but apparently it was like the worst episode ever. She literally cried that night because she's like, what on earth did I do? Commentary, Trek Stars.
Ronald D. Moore Recap.
So you're saying that you wish Star Trek was BSG?
No.
Say for the record that you wish Star Trek had never existed and that Battlestar Galactica was the thing instead.
Warp 5.
Enterprise Season 1 Blu-rays.
Towards the end of that particular documentary, Brannon expresses that he had been also feeling quite dejected and burnt out at the end of the first season, which makes me wonder, did he really have the energy? Was it kind of only just hanging in there?
Trek news and views.
Halloween Treks.
Played the murdering crazy person who has psychic visions and can communicate with the ghosts.
It was kind of a similar character to the one on Voyager, right?
No.
No? Okay.
Literary Treks.
Demons of Aaron Darkness.
Well, what's interesting about it is that, you know, Kira, you know, her gods haven't cast her out. You know, her people have. And it's a lot the same way of, you know, Luther and his 95 Theses and being kicked out of the Catholic Church and all of that happening. Because what Kira has brought to her people is kind of a reformation.
And introducing our TOS show, Standard Orbit.
James Tiberius Kirk.
No, Star Trek 4, I mean, aside from the bookend stuff, I don't really know how much Kirk grows there. It's kind of a standalone story in a lot of ways.
He learns about whales and how it's bad to hunt any animal to extinction.
Which I guess is an important lesson to learn.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of those shows and get your daily Trek Talk fix. We have new Trek Talk for you every day of the week, and some days we even have two shows, and you'll find them all by going to trek.fm/pd for podcast directory to get the links to various sources like iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune. You can stream or download from the website, so many, many ways for you to get the shows. Now, if you have thoughts on today's show, here's how you can contact us. Just go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there on the website. And if you choose to send to a show and choose Literary Treks, that will come to both Matthew and me by email. You can also send us a voicemail from the website. Just look for the tab that says Send Voicemail and click on that. And you can use your webcam's microphone to record a message and upload it to us as an MP3 file right there from the site. Also, go over to our forums and you can talk to us and other listeners about the books and about Star Trek. That's at trek.fm/forums. There's a section there for Literary Treks. There'll be one for this show as well. And of course, for books and comics. Then in social media, you can find us on facebook.com/trekfm. And you'll always find us on Twitter tweeting away about Star Trek all the time under username trekfm. Now, Matthew, what if everyone wants to find you? Where should they go?
Well, Chris, if anybody would like to find me, you can do that on Twitter at MattRushing02, tweeting away about all sorts of different things. And then, of course, we do a show together called The Orb. So we talk Deep Space Nine all the time. So if you enjoyed our talk with Una there about Garak, then, of course, you can find more Deep Space Nine talk where Garak originated on The Orb. Chris, now, when you're not hiding away with Orion Slave Girls or catching up with Morn at DS9, where can people find you?
Yeah, it's my favorite place to be these days.
With Morn or the Orion Slave Girls?
I'll let you decide on that. But Now, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. You can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that same username, as well as on my personal website at cbrianjones.com. And then elsewhere on the network, besides doing The Orb with you, Matthew, you can find me every week on The Ready Room, where I'm joined by hosts from all across the network as we talk about all 5 live-action Star Trek series and Star Trek news. And you'll also find me on Warp 5 with Kate Walsh, where we talk exclusively about Enterprise. So check out all of those shows. Also, before we let you go, we'd like to ask you to please support our sponsor for this week's show, and that sponsor is Squarespace, the web's best hosting and CMS that makes it simple for you to create a beautiful blog, website, portfolio, or an online store with the incredible commerce feature. Create your own space today. Go to squarespace.com for your free 14-day trial and then use offer code TREK10 to get 10% off your lifetime purchase on new accounts. So we really thank Squarespace for their support of Literary Treks and the network. Also, if you'd like to help us personally, you can go to trek.fm/donate to see our original alien illustrations. These are original illustrations by Tobu Ushi, who does most of the artwork that you see on our website, and they're available both as badges and art prints, and you can mix and match, choose which ones you want in which format, choose the level of contribution that's right for you, and we'll get those right over to you. And your contributions help us pay for the costs of production, hosting, and bandwidth that's needed to bring the shows to you every week, so we really appreciate your support of the network.
Thank you so much for joining us, and until next time, live long and read on.
What do you call that, light reading?
To each his own, number one.